So for me, the caliber of a human being, the content of their character, is not the amount of dollars behind them or the fact people might recognize them on the street. The content of somebody's character is, are they an authentic, ethical person? Do they do what they say they're going to do? And do they approach life with what they can do for you rather than what they can get or take from you?
This can't be it. There has to be more. Wait, am I crazy? No. If you're yearning for more and working hard to make your dreams a reality, then you're in the right place. Welcome to Dreamcatchers. It's the only show committed to helping you self-actualize and then transcend, leaving you with the legacy you've always desired. Listen in on conversations with successful philanthropists, entrepreneurs, and founders every week as we connect with them for inspiration, education, and direction. Your host, Jerome Myers, is here to help you exit the matrix and transform into a leader of your own revolution. The question is, do you believe your dreams should be real? Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Dreamcatchers podcast. I'm your host, Jerome, and I've got David Holman in with me today. I don't remember exactly what city he's in because he travels all around the world doing these amazing events where he gets people together who have exited in the VC world, in the family office world. And I think you guys are going to get access to something that most of you don't even know exists today. So with that said, David, thanks for joining me on the Dreamcatchers podcast, man. Good to have you.
My pleasure, Jerome. Thank you for having me. I'll give everyone clarity. I live in Jersey City. So the view behind me is of the World Trade Center and the Empire State. And New York City is my home and has been for 25 years.
Wow. Wow. I feel like Alicia Keys and Jay-Z should be doing a song right now. All right. So I know people are curious. They're like, VC, exit, family office. How does one get into a network where they can have events with that caliber? I'll call it caliber of people, even though some people may be challenged by my use of that word in that way.
So let me qualify what I would mean by caliber first, so everyone gets the context. So for me, the caliber of a human being, the content of their character, is not the amount of dollars behind them or the fact people might recognize them on the street. The content of somebody's character is, are they an authentic, ethical person? Do they do what they say they're going to do? And do they approach life with what they can do for you rather than what they can get or take from you? So I run a private community. It is called Orchestrated Connecting. I'm a classical composer in my other life, but few people have ever met a living composer. Maybe you've heard one now. And so I realized that 8 years ago, I had to build a code to get to that caliber of people. And that code, which hasn't changed, is the only people I want in my orbit, as a mutual friend would vet you, Jerome, to me, not just to say, hey, David, you could be on this really cool, awesome Dreamcatchers podcast, but that you would be somebody vouched for as an action-oriented natural giver that I or they would leave my kids with.
Whoa. That's a high bar.
No, it's a high bar, right? Most people have maybe 3 to 5 people they'd leave my kid with or theirs. I wanted that integrity because when you're in this world of celebrity, family office, venture capitalist, connection to a politician, connections to name somebody ever would want an autograph from on this planet. What I care about is what are the actions of those people, many of whom are friends, are taking, and what are the actions that can be taken in my community? So instead of focusing, and this was the key part, instead of focusing on the end result, I need to get to Steven Spielberg or Tom Hanks or Alicia Keys or Rihanna or Ray Dalio or whomever it might be that everyone could recognize as the main brand. The secret behind it all is the person they trust or the people they trust. And those people are connectors. They're gatekeepers. But what they really are people who have built trust and value. And they're not just part of those inner circles. They're how I believe actually the entire inner circle works. So my community is a community of connectors connecting to each other.
I like this because I feel like I lack the gift of discernment. And so one of the filters that I use is you can only get to me if somebody I trust brings you to me. And that it's almost like a mafia, right? Where a made man has introduced you to the family in order to be able to have, I'll call it access. There's probably a better word for it, but have access to the folks and be in proximity to the people.
Here's what I'd say, right? How do you get authentic access for you? Because if you say, right, you have a podcast, you've interviewed tons of people, these people are incredible human beings with great success. What happens when somebody filters for you, somebody who's not worthy of that, who's a challenger, a waste of your time, who maybe uses what you have as a platform in the wrong way? I wanted a code by which somebody's reputation would be, you know, on the stand for how they introduced me or asked me to take the time. And if it's something that's not mutually beneficial, then I ask them to say that. I need you to connect to my friend's sister. She lost her job. She's an incredible, you know, climate change investor. Do you know any VCs that should talk to her? But if you give the context and the purpose and the why behind asking for time, not only do you have a filter, you have a preparation for an elevation of what that connection should be. And that's what I call purposeful connecting. It's not just access. It's about making sure that the asks on both sides are warranted, accepted, mutually beneficial. And then you start the conversation with where most people end the conversation, because you start with that purposeful need and things go much further, much more quickly. And for you and I, who probably have very limited time on this planet, the way to maximize it is to set all of that up with intention first.
This is fascinating because you're so intentional with your word choice. And for me, like, I label people mutually beneficial or not, right? And then there's three other categories a person who's not mutually beneficial can fall into, the worst being draining. But you are taking it to the interaction level. And you're saying on the interaction level, the interaction is mutually beneficial or not. Does that ever go up to the total relationship, or do you keep things in a, I'll call it transactional, even though I know you don't actually see it in that light, but just for the
interaction. My view, I totally get what you're saying. So in the end, what you want is for things to be relational, even when transaction happens. And so the more that you can get to somebody's why, right, the more you can understand what they're really after, then what I can do, and I'm not the only one, I now have a network of 1,500 people who I would leave my kids with who do this all different ways. You have a reason for people to get to that higher level. It's not just intentional or purposeful or mutually beneficial. It's what's going to come out of it that the best people who connect can actually discern. So I'll give you an example. I was at a family office conference speaking actually earlier this week in Savannah, which is one of my favorite towns. And at this dinner near the end of the night, this unbelievable guy named Garrett, who's former NFL, CFL, like unbelievably like strong, but charismatic linebacker, sat down and talked about DAOs and the future of the players economy and ownership in the NFL and this entire massive, beautiful vision to bring fans and players together. Like, I was inspired sitting with him as we both ate dinner way too late for both of us that evening. And the minute I heard what he had to say, it triggered two other friends, both former players, one actually a Super Bowl champ, who had a technology that is incredibly accepted in the NFL already. That was the exact thing that Garrick was missing in a partnership that might be, because they're just setting up their call this week, it might be mutually beneficial to both because of not the nature of their business, but who and what they plan to elevate from it. And in making that interaction, turns out that one of those players actually played with the other guy's teammate for years. Two of them were Jaguars, two played with people at West Virginia. Like, it was all this inner circle, but in an email interaction to tee up camaraderie and brotherhood and a larger purpose from literally a text message and email, takes the understanding and the insight of not just the why or the purpose behind somebody, but to set the stage correctly for how they're going to elevate each other. And this is where I talk about, like, this is the highest end of connection. This isn't just mutually beneficial. This is me after we interact and I'm on your podcast now going, okay, I know you said it'd be really great to recommend some guests, but I really want to know who's going to elevate this. Is it people in real estate? Is it people you need in certain states? Are there, you know, celebrities that invest in real estate? Like, the more you drill down into that exact specificity and why behind it, it's not limiting. It's actually freeing when you're talking to a connector, because we're all wired to come up with the right people, knowing we've already mined and understood that shared purpose.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's solving a problem, right? And if you can get specific on the variables, then there's a right answer. And, you know, we picked specifically you for this because of X, Y, or Z. Yeah, and then when I think about the relationships that you talked about, it's so funny how we feel like we're so far away from a person or a resource, and it's literally there. It might be 1 degree of separation, possibly 2. Very rarely is it more than 4. And so the idea that you can't get to who you need to get to is challenging for me. I'll say challenging. So
yeah,
you dropped in that you're a gospel composer, and then we moved on to the other stuff.
Classical, not gospel. I grew up actually in the deep South, where like a lot of friends were like in gospel choirs, but I'm a romantic style classical composer. People think my music sounds like movie music, but it's lush and melodic. Usually it's like one melody sits with somebody and it like helps them drive and find their purpose in their day. So I actively work as a composer. I just got a new ballet commission. I'm starting on in June when at least one of my 2 kids is in summer camp.
That is amazing. How does one get into that? It was just something fascinating you said at the beginning. I was like, well, how do you just go to like training? Like, how does that work?
So I was banging on pots at 4 years old, and I wasn't great at banging on pots. And my dad is an amateur piano player, but his father, my grandfather, who although I never met, we have his tenor saxophone in our closet. He was a big band musician in Philly in the 20s and 30s. And so I had music in my family. I also have theater. My dad's a famous Shakespearean scholar. So arts for me was something you should just do because it's what my parents did or other parts of my family did. And so I started on what's called Suzuki piano training, and I learned by ear how to play a whole bunch of music. And then when I was 12, I quit because my brother, who's an incredible video game writer and musician, was playing the same pieces as me. And this will date me. I quit. And then Nirvana came out with Smells Like Teen Spirit, and I wanted to learn it on piano. So my teacher taught me. I went back in doing like grunge rock and like U2 and the Chili Peppers and Dave Matthews and all these things that you don't combine with like Brahms or Mozart. And the next thing I knew, I was improvising. And from improvising, I started to write. And I realized that I had a whole language in my head, a whole musicality that since 12, I have not stopped writing. You can find 6 of my albums on iTunes, some on Spotify. The device to my right, I can't mention because Jeff Bezos created it and she'll turn on. If you say to her, hey, so-and-so, play the music, you can hear my music. But classical music is very private. We consume it everywhere. If you were to delete classical music from commercials or movies, we'd find most of those boring. But no one actively seeks out that in terms of consumption, which means that it's not, I have something in between a hobby and a career. But I've had 207 works performed, have 8 public albums. So I exist this way. But what I realized was it wasn't actually my calling. It's the same calling, but the way I want to write a melody that resonates with people, what I've done in building this large-scale global network, this orchestrated network that I've built, is to find those resonances between people and to connect them in the same way ideally my music hits at that core. And so I own my brand. I now trademark it. I'm going to be coming out with a book this fall. Doing a raise for a tech company now to solve this authenticity and connection tech. But the thing I want to qualify is it might seem great now that I've worked with Ray Dalio's family office, that I chair a big fancy theater foundation board that helps New York City youth. I live in Manhattan. I grew up in small town Florida where the Florida Gators are. So that's Tim Tebow, Tom Petty. If anyone remembers the preacher that wanted to burn the Quran and Gatorade, that's sort of it for that town in terms of international fame. I grew up not knowing wealth holders. Grew up knowing a handful of friends and other professors' kids and people I played soccer with. I stumbled into college here in New York and got down to Manhattan. And over the years, like built from nothing, this network and this world that I inhabit because of the one thing that had always haunted me as a kid, which is I never fit in any network or community I'd ever been into. And I turned that into my superpower because by not fitting into any, I realized I was part of all of them.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just me. It was everyone who has these diverse relationships and famous relationships. And they don't feel like they have that tribe where their best friend comes over every day. They go to the same people's house. They travel and they somehow know someone, but that's still lonely. I found that there's actually thousands of us who have built incredible value no one values. And so my mission is to make relationship value valued. And that's what I try to do every single day.
You said they've created tremendous value that no one values.
Yep.
Tell me more about that.
So the way to understand this is, and this is actually part of the first chapter of my book I'm writing called Orchestrated Connections. So there's a difference between what you actually need and what you want or desire. And I believe that anyone who says you deserve something doesn't deserve it, because I don't think people deserve things. I think people have wants and needs and desires, and what we really need is always different than what we perceive that we need to have. And so I try to filter out when people have to have something and when they don't. But in many cases, I am approached by people of great privilege, of great success. They've raised $50 million into a fund. They're an exited CEO. They're brothers on Broadway. Like, we're talking upper echelon human beings. Now, the ones in my network, I want to be clear, would never ask this way. But a regular ask, 3 to sometimes 30 times a week for me, is somebody saying, I put all of this money and all of this time into something that's great for me. If you could just find me the exact person to co-invest or to champion this or to get me into X, I'll bring you along. And what I'm thinking is, I've been doing this for 8 years. I've built a purposeful community with a reach that is probably one of the most enviable in the authenticity of my network. Meaning when somebody says they have access to the Pope or the Dalai Lama or Paul McCartney, they do. Like, that's the nature of this network I built. But no one wants to feel like people are working through you to get to somebody else. Yet constantly, pervasively, this is what people do. They ask completely innocently, naively, nonchalantly, or purposely as a taker. They say, Jerome, I saw podcast guest number 4, somebody that should invest in my tech. Will you connect me to that person? And they might have no idea that that person who helped launch your podcast with somebody you spent 8 years developing a relationship with, got into deals with real estate with them, helped their kid out of a problem, have gone out of leaps and bounds to build an enormous amount of value, but I just want to go through you to this person. I don't value everything you put in. I'm not even going to ask about it.
Yeah.
We constantly live in a world where people feel what they want or desire is more important than what you both need, which is why I make every ask purposeful and mutual. Because how on earth, right? I'll give you if I give you the new analogy I'm trying out. I tried it out on LinkedIn yesterday. 2 friends asked if I was okay. The rest are getting it so far. So this was the analogy to just make this inanity of it make sense. So an individual builds this multi-million dollar house with huge fertile land all around it. And they say to you, Jerome, you know, if you can go get an apple tree and you can plant it and you can water it and you can help that tree grow, I'll give you 2 apples from it. Does that sound fair? Right? It's insane, right? But this is what I am asked every single day, every single week, because people think, oh, he's extremely connected. He can just get me $1 billion for what I need. Get me to Rihanna. Get me to all these people that I know I have access to. But why on earth would I want to pitch somebody I've built a relationship with for something they don't need to ruin my relationship for somebody else who's not even bothered to build one with me? We somehow live in this skewed perspective. That's okay. And yet we would recoil if it was asked of us the same way. And so this is what I mean by making it valued. Like, there's a massive hypocrisy and injustice in what that means. And I view it as a massive opportunity to create ethics and a code around it, so that when people ask with purpose and it's received, there's a gratitude, a chain of connections, and then you build community from it, rather than destroying relationships or not benefiting the people who put the value in before they tried to take value out.
So I got exposure to this in college when I saw companies come in and recruit, but they never wanted to invest in scholarships or participate in classroom work sessions. They just wanted to pluck from the vine, but there was no watering of the vine. There was no tilling of the field. And so I've been carrying this a long time, but I've never heard anybody liken it to an apple tree or a fruit tree of any sort. And people just want to pluck from the fruit tree. I think folks are looking for the shortcut. I think we live in a hack society, right? Well, I could save you time. I could save you money if you pay the piper on the way to getting the thing that you want. I think a lot of those promises are empty, but you've said authentic probably 5 times since we've been in the episode. And what does that mean to you? Because we define some other terms, but we haven't defined authentic, and it's been repeated multiple times.
So authentic is one of those terms a lot of people like to throw around because it makes them sound like they're authentic. I believe that authenticity is by being able to take an action that benefits others, not just how you are or who you are. You can be a great person. You don't have to be a super connector. You can be a community organizer. You can add a PTA. Like, this isn't only about getting access to the elite of the world. I think that when authenticity exists, that there's a mutual respect that also includes a mutual respect of boundaries, and that the truly authentic people are people who do what they say they're going to do. And that's it. I do not believe you can judge anything else until you look at somebody's actions, not their words. And so for me, that's how I look at what authenticity really is, because authenticity is one of the greatest things you can feed into relationships that increase the one thing you can never buy, which is your reputational value. You cannot increase somebody's perception of yourself by paying for it. You can SEO, like optimize yourself to search on Google. That doesn't mean that when somebody says, "Hey, David, how was your interview with Jerome?" I go, "You know, before we got on air, he said it was going to be fascinating. And like, I have never been more awake in a conversation this week than this conversation. I think you should listen to everything he's done." And then I have to follow up to say, I listened to episode 4 and episode 12 as two of my markers of just what I was doing while I was traveling. I'm super tired today, but now I feel pumped. I can't remember who he interviewed, but I got a sense of who he was as a person from it. And I think you guys are going to benefit from talking. And unless you can back it up with action, unless you can back it up with words, unless you understand that everything you do is being judged and looked at, you don't understand what happens until people start to judge you for what you don't do. And that scares most people, no matter what circumstance, no matter what fame.
Now we're going deep now, because I've been toying with this concept that what you don't do defines you as a man. And it's the first time I've said it publicly. I've just kind of been rolling around in my head, but I just think that so many folks are of the mindset that I did this and I did that, and that's why I am who I am. But I think there's some restraint that has to happen. I think there's some things that are off limits. There are things that are outside of your character, some things that are outside of your moral compass. And you know, I know that you might have been going down the path of, well, you didn't do what you said you were going to do. And so that negatively impacts the way that I view you and whether I really believe you're an authentic person or not. But I think there's also these restraints that are necessary for us to actually play at the highest levels, because I think those things actually give you the freedom.
Yeah. So I'll tell you one thing that's a little off base, but was eye-opening for me. I try to be a really good dad. My kids are 9 and 6 right now, and I try to teach them mindfulness and deep breathing and everything. You know where I think they've learned 70% of how to be?
You watching.
By watching me when I'm not trying to parent them, by just how I clean, how I travel. And I'm a neurotic mess of a travel. My kids are going to be like my dad. I'm like my dad. So thank you, Dad, but like, don't travel with me. If you want a calm moment, because I got to make the plane on time, I got to get there 2 hours early. I live in fear of those things. And I wasn't taught that. I studied it. So that definition, right, what you're saying, right, whether it's what you do or what you don't do, it's both of it. But in either way, it's your intent behind it. If you say you're going to do something and you don't do it, then you should be judged for it. if you say you can't do something and therefore won't do it, that also is a really gracious place to be in many cases, right? Because the clarity is, it results in not being ghosted, not living in between. Like, I'm raising for a tech company right now for my friends. I'm asking them to opt in, but I'm also saying, if you don't, just say no. Just don't let me think, hey, you never got back to me. It's been 6 months. I've been wondering if you care. Just say, I can't do it right now. Right. Then relationship shifts back. But I want to pick up on what you said about, you know, those companies like coming to cherry pick, right? And like how that defines some of your character, right? When we look at groups coming in to take from or to give opportunity who don't invest in the system, that for me is the pervasive problem with our society. It's a systemic problem because we don't look at the system. And we scratch our heads and we go, well, listen, like, why don't we have more female engineers? Why don't we have black and brown kids who want to code? Why don't we have this? It's because we didn't invest in it. We didn't put time, energy, or intent. And then when one person makes it, we act as if that one person is the example of how everyone else can make it. And I listen now, right? I've gone to a lot of conferences where a lot of my friends have actually been former like athletes and sports stars, like unbelievable successful human beings. And their entire purpose, to help every one of their friends who wasn't that 1% who made it, realize there's a future beyond that one dream.
Yeah.
Because you have to love the journey in order to really have success. And that journey, the pain, blood, sweat, tears, all of this comes with inherent risk that the minute it's over, you think your life is over. Until you learn how to thrive and love the journey of it wherever life takes you. And that's not taught in schools. It's not taught in the workforce. It's only taught through mentorship. It's only taught through people who, go back to that word, have an authenticity together because they have a common thread, a common core. And my world is to ignite that. To figure out that bottom, right? That core, and go, here's why the two of you should connect. Not you're both X or Y as a stereotype or a geography, or you both used to work at 3M or now you're in multifamily real estate. Like, I'm connecting two friends to each other because of what they rejected from what they did in their early life into what they want to do now and are scared to actually do. And I'm putting both of them together so that they can realize by them both being afraid, they can find courage together. And they're incredible people, but by confiding in me, I'm encouraging them to confide in each other, and something will come from it substantially because of who they are, what they've done. But if you're crippled by fear and you feel you're alone, what's the one thing you want first? You want to be heard. And then for being heard and listened to, you want to be receptive to hearing others. And if two people are in the same place, they're already in a better place by recognizing that.
A lot of people want to unlock their ultimate potential, but lack the strategy, support, and stamina necessary to achieve their major goals. They often try to overcome these challenges by trying to do it on their own, causing frustration, fatigue, and eventually failure. We have developed a model for a center life, aka the red pill, to help them bolster their beliefs, gain clarity on their path to success, and provide accountability as they take action on their goals. When they take the red pill, they rapidly accelerate attainment of their goals and begin to experience a life of significance and impact. Want to find out more? Hop over to JeromeMyers.co. Now, let's get back to the episode. Knowing you're not alone is so valuable. And I think so many people hide in shame because they think they're the only one. And so anytime you can pull back the veil and make it clear that you're not the only one going through it, or there's this other person over here who's not that different than you, or overcame the same thing that you're dealing with, I think people get a real boost from that. So let's talk about Exited Founders, because I know they're a part of your community. Mm-hmm. What are some of the commonalities, and we're going down the same vein of you're not alone. What are some of the commonalities between them? Like, what is their experience post-exit? Do they wonder what their next is, or do you think most of them already have it figured out? Do you see them struggling on the backside of the exit?
So there's a couple different types, but I attract one type. So I'll give you the positive rosy version first. I have dozens and dozens of friends who have had unbelievable exits. some in the hundreds of millions, some that not only like had a unicorn, but then like, then they became investors. One picked 19 other unicorns. So we're talking like super successful people. The reason I say it's a filter perspective is what they built before their exit was a purposeful community. They may not have defined it as such, but they were already mentoring other founders. They were already investing in a different ecosystem. They didn't wake up one day with 50, 100, couple million, you know, $100 million and go, what do I do next? They actually had their head in the sand to solve that because they already had what was next planned. And in many cases, because my network are the conveners and the connectors, they're the ones that are helping the other founders that really just woke up to what the reality is from a successful exit and wealth to figure out what's next. And so what I see constantly are now these founder ecosystems. And every one of these founder ecosystems has a whole bunch of successful people in it. And they've each figured out part of it. There's the wealth management part of it. There's the, if you're a successful founder, you've had an itch that doesn't stop now that you're rich. It's what's next. And I always care about that what next with friends of mine. Some build funds. You know, my buddy, whose name is Brian Geister, who runs an amazing multifamily office named Pennington Partners. He's out of Houston now. He has an entire entrepreneurship ecosystem where you come in. It's not just about managing the wealth and in specifically investing in opportunity zones and all of the rest. You are with a community of successful founders co-investing together around purpose. The dude is one of the smartest people around the founder ecosystem because he was a successful exit and founder himself, and everything he was lacking, he built into a sophisticated business. So like, that's the rosy colored lens that I look at. I look at all of these people who didn't wake up surprised by it, but the non-rosy side, like if you win the lottery and your name has to be sent publicly, everyone who wasn't around when you needed it now wants to be a friend. And it's just one of those things where it's not just with successful founders. It's anytime people feel that the guilt of what they need or what they have doesn't equate to what's actually happening in the world. So slightly different example, but about a month and a half after Floyd's murder, I called up a really amazing friend of mine. And she says, oh, I'm just incredibly busy. I was like, listen, I'm not calling you because you're my only Black friend. I'm calling you to say, how many people have called you because you're their only Black friend? And she laughed on the phone, chortled actually. She runs this incredible group, my friend Bahia, named BC Include, like mission-driven to help founders of color, women of color, all of this. And she just laughed because we've been friends for a while. And I reached out because I understood the circumstance she was in, which I'm sure you will probably in too, right? Everyone be like, hey, I was on your podcast. You're the one Black guy that I know. How are you doing? And in my network, like I've run a network of diversity from day one. You walk into my events, which are private events for connectors, and white men are the minority often in that room. Cause I've literally said to people, diversity is the key to ingenuity and success. So let's stop thinking that if we all stand like each other, look like each other, walk like each other, that's how innovation happens. Cause we wouldn't have Apple. We wouldn't have Google. We wouldn't have the microchips for Qualcomm. We wouldn't have most of the innovation on this planet, including blood transfusions or anything, if we just had a whole bunch of white people like me saying, what should we do to help the world? And so I have purposely, and I'm blatant about this to be clear, I have purposely said from day one, I want a network that looks like 2040 today. I want a community that is as diverse as the world is, not how power currently exists. And by doing that, I created a comfort level for people to do what's often uncomfortable when they only have one Black friend, one brown friend, whatever it might be, because it was a commonality of purpose that sat above, why don't you look like? And so with founders, it's the same thing. They start to talk to other people who look like them and talk like them. And all of a sudden, they have to go into two different deals because this person has the best deal on the planet. And anyone who's ever had to qualify, they have the best deal on the planet. Doesn't, because the best news on the planet no one has access to but like Bono and Jay-Z and like people at Andreessen Horowitz and Sequoia. Like, it's just the way the power works. And so I look at this as like, what's the nature of this power? What happens from an exit founder And the ones that thrive have a community to lean on without an ask back. And then they figure out how to dig in, how to use their position and their privilege. But usually at some point in what they did, and I know this from how you represent yourself, right? How you have built your career, your methodology, your investments into a purposeful podcast, a purposeful methodology. You took how you overcame that adversity and made it something to help others and elevate others alongside you. That mentality is the same mentality I see pervasively for those who are successful, who thrived during COVID and felt weird that they were thriving during this pandemic, where suddenly everything they want is happening more than before, even if they're just in their home. Where in my case, like my four-year-old was punching me in the knees or higher while I was on like interviews or calls, because you can't give them an iPad forever while you're pod parenting. So like, I'm giving you this version because like the answer is like, look what you built. How many of your fans pay attention to that, right? You put it out there, but there's the difference of, is he self-promoting this or is he building a community so that more people connect around that authenticity, that purposefulness, than just what he needs? And so success in founding is success in building something that's incredible for the world with a great exit and a community alongside it. The people who have that success and don't have the community, they go broke.
Say more.
They're lonely.
Why do they go broke?
I mean, because you can have a whole amount of success, right? I've seen a lot of this happen, not just with successful founders, successful athletes, successful celebrities. And what they thrived on was the rush of that, where that success was going to take them. And then when they got there, look what happened. And when it was gone, look what happened. Now people want them for their money. They're more susceptible because they don't know how to trust. And my world is around building more of that trust with people who get really wary that every conversation is about taking something from them.
Yeah.
And we live in that world where that's okay. And I don't think it's okay. I think if you have means and needs, you should help people. But I don't think it's okay to people assume if you have money that they have a right to be offended if you don't want to help them. It goes both ways. There has to be a respect in it.
Yeah. And I don't know that they're actually asking for help, because I know help requires you to do something. I see a lot of people who just want you to do it for them. And that's not help. It's really interesting. But I think the other thing I would say is a lot of people are just looking for a reason to be offended, or a reason why they weren't successful. They want to place blame on others instead of taking responsibility for the outcome of themselves. And so I was listening to Earn Your Leisure podcast, and they had a lady on who, I guess she has a fund that invests in founders. And I can't remember her name right now, but she talks about how being in Silicon Valley, some of the other folks who have more established funds said, hey, she can't raise more than 25 or 30 million. Like, that's the peak she'll ever raise. And how, like, she's said stuff about them on Twitter and they block her and all this other stuff. And I just find it really interesting when people take that approach of kind of throwing rocks at the establishment. I just don't know how you win by creating enemies. Not to say that get along, but.
Yeah, I totally agree to that. Unfortunately, in this world, change has happened from people who were a minority figuring out how to become a vocal majority in doing so. Mm. And my hope is for women founders and women-led funds and BIPOC-led funds that at some point, the systematic failure of investing in those fund managers or those founders will be changed. But for the last decade, several of my friends, very well-known female founders and investors, have said it's around the era, maybe 2% of women get those investments, but it hasn't changed. And actually it got worse last year.
It did.
And so you can throw rocks all you want. The people throwing rocks have really big walls and it doesn't actually affect. The way you affect this, which is part of my mission in life, it's, I don't just champion diversity and have a really powerful network to do it. I want impact to change. I want people to understand that one of the best investable markets in the United States is a $170 billion market. That's Black women. Like, the biggest rising market of consumers that does not have innovation and technology and things to commercialize that market is a market completely underlooked that's a rounding error for those founders and people trying to build within it. It makes zero sense to me. The largest consumer gender on the planet is women, and yet we do not invest in women or women-owned businesses or women-focused businesses. And the majority of the consumers are women.
Yeah.
And so, like, data, right? People hear this data, they see it, but they don't have to. Until you build authentic relationships and trust to say, this is an opportunity, it also might be impact. But by investing in this, you're going to invest in the future. It's the same argument now around climate change. The prevailing theory was, climate change is something that may or may not exist. It's in the future. You can't make money now from it. But the future of energy is renewable energy, and the largest investors in renewable energy on the planet are the largest companies making their money currently off of energy. So there's a shift, and the thing that we thought was destroying is actually starting, not nearly there, to change it. And so I view this as you have to get the people to come to the table. You have to put the reputation on the line to say, hey, to all those VCs who've done incredibly well in Silicon Valley, and by the way, built the backbone of American wealth, because all the rise in American wealth is all of the tech that comes from those same people. But what they do with it matters. And some of those people are unbelievable human beings changing the world in ways that we can't even understand or see. And others, I'm not going to talk about those. I'm going to talk about the ones that, like, want to understand how they can better others and elevate, because their journey was a hard one until they got to a point where they didn't think it was as hard for others.
Mm. It's easy to forget when you get on the other side of the hill, right? When you get to the top of the hill, it's easy to forget how hard it was coming up the hill, especially for those who
not if you built community while you did it. Not if you built your tribe, your purpose as you do it. Why are those people more successful after? Why are they happier after? Because they didn't become that success on their own.
Mm. And I don't think anybody ever does, but a lot of people, I think, get onto the top of the hill and proclaim king of the mountain because they don't want anybody else to have credit for the thing. And I know there's some self-image things that go on there, and there's probably some guilt, some shame, and some worthiness. And you used the word deserve earlier, so we'll throw that one into the pot too. But I've watched a lot of people, and maybe the ego was always there, but when they get to a certain level of success, it is about making everybody suffer the way they did or figure it out or... One of the funniest things I ever heard is pull yourself up by your bootstraps. I'm like, what if I don't even have boots on, man? Like, what do I do then?
Well, here's what I'd say, right? I've been lucky. Partly it's living in New York. Partly it's the world of coming from arts into family office and wealth. Not my own wealth, but the people around me, just to be clear. I've met or worked with A-list Hollywood, A-list Broadway. I've met people who are, they're giving pledge billionaires. They're some of the most humble, sincere, amazing people I've ever met, who own known brands, who are literally, like, I was at a gala or a board that I chair, sitting having the most organic conversation with Steven Spielberg around helping young kids embrace more theater in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Humble, I mean, powerful human beings who know what they're doing and take charge, but in an interaction, they're not there.
Right.
To tell you, like, who they are. I have multiple friends, over a dozen, who have won Super Bowls or NBA championship. And all they think is, how am I going to give back? What am I going to do to help others? What's next? They're not even wearing their rings half the time because the rings are clunky and hard to put on a suit with and all these other things. But, like, you don't have to have an ego to have success. But if you don't have the success that has made you love the journey and you think you deserve more, then you have the ego. And every one of those people who creates problems their ego isn't what they've done. It's that they have that slight or large inferiority of what they could have done more of. And everyone I've met who's incredibly famous, it was part of their journey, just part. The founder, the celebrity, whatever it might be, it was a part of their life, and they have to be excited about what's next, not just talking about what they've done endlessly back and forth. It's why I'm excited more every day for what I've built, which is so far 3 years in a successful business in making connection and ecosystem building its own business, in building a community that went from New York to events and around the US, soon to be Canada and the UK and expanding. And technology, I think, will actually work to change how we connect with each other. A book around everything we're talking about now, that vernacular and that purposeness, so that everyone can find and see the beauty of the community around them and live in a way that's more beautiful because we can make our lives a symphony. And I love every part of that journey, while also losing my job during COVID, getting divorced, being stressed about my finances, watching my parents age and not be close to me, and everything else that is also just the reality of life. But I don't wake up making myself or thinking of myself as a victim or a martyr or what more I am supposed to get out of this. I think about what I'm supposed to give to this and make that something that catches fire with others, ideally in every conversation I can have.
So the one thing that I think the listeners are probably pondering at this point is, well, David, if I always focus on giving, when will I ever receive, or how will I know that I'm receiving what I'm supposed to receive? And so, I see that you sit in gratitude, like you just have this aura of gratitude around you. But go ahead, tell me how that people can be.
So let me give you this. It's my one rule in my network. It'll probably be a good thing to close us out for this hour as well. So, primary problem, if we live in gratitude and we give and no one values what we give, we're just giving into a box with a bucket with a hole in it. And so what I believe is, as you give, you have to demonstrate the value of what you're giving. So for instance, I'm going to put this on air. Jerome, based on your podcast, based on your business, I think that I'm going to connect you with my buddy, Brad Hart, if he's up for it. He is one of the most incredible friends that I've ever met. He's worked with Tony Robbins. He's actually now investing with the community and the exact type of stuff in real estate that you do. This has been a friend of mine for 6 years. I respect him. I love him as a human being. I put a lot of energy into this relationship. And he is somebody who also, like me, has insane relationships. But I think you guys are going to see and get along at a really important level and maybe do business together. I'm going to ask him if he wants to meet you, maybe by making him listen to the entire podcast till we get to 50 something minutes in where this ask is. And that'll be the joke on him that now he's named on air, but he's a really great guy. So he'd love it. And if something comes from that interaction, I'd like you to thank me for it. But I'd like you to thank my friend Anish, who introduced me to you. I'd like you to think about how you met him. And I'm going to thank my friend Scott, who introduced me to Anish, because I believe that we should thank everyone who has brought us together for this introduction now for you and Brad to invest and change the way we look at real estate together. And so you can demonstrate gratitude, but you can also, what I call, honor the chain at the same time. Mm. And what's easy for a giver to do, easy for a giver, is to express gratitude to all the people who have helped. This is a selfless act. It's the one rule in my community that I enforce. And to date, there have been 27 people no longer in my network because they didn't follow this rule. But it's the actual rule. If you are selfless in your gratitude, but you were also saying, look what substantially happened to me and look at the people that I know, you are able to act in a way with a positive ego to say, look at all these powerful, incredible people that I know. Look what happened to me. Look what success happened to me because of this value. And you can exist simultaneously as somebody selfless and selfish by actually asking for the value you are giving to be given back to you. That is the hack. That is not a quick hack, but it's the way I have found to get people who are just living in the world of gratitude, but why hasn't something come to me? It's how to change it. And so this is how I live in every interaction. Not that, you know, we had a great podcast interview and then like I had a meeting later and I had great coffee. But if somebody listens to this and says, I am a super connector, I'm a Giving Pledge family. I've wanted to figure out how to do more with my life. And by listening to Jerome Meyer's podcast, I reached out to him. He introduced me to David, and now David and I can do things together. Unless they thank you for that, I won't talk to them again.
Oh, wow.
Because I want that gratitude to be a pervasive chain that builds community as we do this. And unless it is that, then you are taking away from it just by ignoring the fact that came through purposeful relationships.
And all opportunities come through relationships. Through you that I meet other people. It's through Anesh that I met you. And what a wonderful conversation today, and just a different perspective. And so I know you said all of your events are invitation only, but if people want to know more about Orchestrated Connecting or the movement that you're on, and we'll, if you want to come back, open invitation when you're ready to start talking about the book. Love to have you come back and talk about the book. But if they want to learn more about Orchestrated Connecting, what's the way to do that?
So if you Google me or look at my website, you can find my email and my phone number. People can reach out to me and they can literally say, I heard this is who I am. But it needs to have that thoughtfulness, because I get inbound hundreds of things every day. What I look for, whether it's a LinkedIn request, an email, not a text message, because I'll forget that you texted me, because then my kid will need more Pokemon cards that fell into a puddle and then I just can't do it. Like, that's what life actually is. If you know somebody who knows me, if you would identify as a connector, ask them about this network. It's private for a reason, and it's private because I want every conversation to be of trust. And because my network are people who literally have access to like Jay-Z and Rihanna and all of these incredible human beings, I need to be really careful with that. And so people approaching me with intent would be one thing. People who have said, I reached out to you, but just before that, I thanked Jerome for listening to this podcast, and I suggested people he should talk to first. That's going to go much farther with me, because it means they listened to the last 2 minutes of our podcast. But what it also means is that they actually respected what you did by agreeing to talk to me and taking this time today. And the more we live in that world of respect, and the more I see it, the more in my limited time in life, I'll make other people a priority, because that intent demonstrates content of character that only happens when people respect even the outreach to somebody that they don't know.
This is magical, man. It's so refreshing to speak to somebody who doesn't just want to transact, who wants to relate and have a relationship. You know, you mentioned some of the tough things that you've been through over the past couple of years, and I just want to encourage you. You are a dream catcher. You are changing the way that people get in alignment and then go out and do the mission, and being in submission, under the mission, and walking in purpose and acting in purpose, I think is the thing that's going to make the world a better place. And you're creating an environment and a network, and I'll call it an ecosystem more than an environment, for people to do that at speed, right? You can snail your way through it and meet people happenstance, but you've created something where you're curating introductions so that people are meeting the folks that they need to meet in order to execute the reason why they've been placed on this planet. And I think those opportunities are rare, and we have to take advantage of them. And so you have to sit in a space of gratitude when somebody is shaving months, years off of what would have taken in order to do it on your own or do it by happenstance. So David, thank you so much for being so generous with your time and sharing your message. I love to close these out with asking the one question that I ask every guest without fail. And that's, what's the one thing you want the listeners to take away from the episode?
The one thing is this. I used to think it was okay to say you're an ally for change. I no longer think that's the truth. I think you either have to be a champion of it and take action, or we're not going to correct these systemic challenges that we face. It's why, like, I wrote my buddy Jeff, who's like, what can I do to help with your event in Venice in April? And I said, I'm just going to be blunt. I was like, bring more Black people, please. My network in New York is hundreds and hundreds of people of color, and my network in LA is too white for me. So So please do it. He's already brought a few, but like, I can't say I'm an ally of diversity and then do events that are like 90% white, because LA is definitely not that as a demographic for the city. Right. And so I have now taken this mantra that you have to be a champion of it. You have to ask for it. You have to be unafraid for people's responses. And unless we're going to change that, and again, Jeff is a close friend. He's an advisor to my startup. I respect the guy, but I don't want him to show up as the token. South Park coined that term years ago. And like, it still is the same everywhere I go. Mm-hmm. Every event but mine, I literally see one or two people from other races and a handful of women, mostly being hit on. The world doesn't look like this. So why? Because people say, and they preach they're an ally of this, but they don't actually do anything about it. So I believe everyone needs to champion that in whatever way they're looking at their life. And if you're in a community of only Black people or brown people or Asian people, find the white people. Ask them, because the commonalities are greater than the differences, but we are taught as children it doesn't matter. And then we pod back up, we tribe back up out of comfort that isn't about people. It's about something that systemically creates these problems. So that's what I believe, because if diversity is the key to innovation, connection is what we need for human elevation and to eradicate mental challenges and loneliness, then find the people who resonate with you, not who look like you, and be a champion of that. So that's what I have to say is like final takeaway.
I'll put an exclamation point on the backside of it, because Robert F. Smith was giving a talk that I was lucky enough to be at last week. And he just talked about the results that diversity gets. And he talks about the results of his fund and how much diversity they actually have. And it's like, if you don't want those results, then don't have diversity. And so.
Correct. And if you want to actually look at what happens in society from it, take the United States of America. Why did we catapult into a new century? Because of the diversity. Everything else was pocketed and everyone was the same religion mostly. And we fled that. And we wouldn't have jazz, we wouldn't have hip hop, we wouldn't have many things without the unfortunate nature of what slavery was. But we wouldn't have what is truly American culture without the acceptance of that on such a scale in a multi-billion dollar way. Yet we don't invest in it the same way. That's what doesn't make sense. Why not? Like, why not do it? You take a massive population, 30-something% of this country, that is a multi-billion dollar market, that is buying things in the billions, and we don't think there's innovation or investment in that, not to the scale we need, and the majority gender, which everyone calls their mom when they need something. Why don't we invest in it? It makes zero sense. Zero sense. Yeah. And so build community around it. You affect the change. That is my mission. And with that, Jerome, I want to say thank you for having me part of this and ranting and raving about what I hope will be useful for other people.
Oh, it's paradigm shifting, David. Thank you so much. And to the listeners, your dreams should be real. We'll talk to you in the next episode.
Thank you for joining the tribe today. We would love to hear from you. Please don't forget to rate, like, and share. Perhaps someone you know could benefit from what we've discussed. Until the next time, remember that your dreams should be real.